To the fourth and final case of the day, which is 21-11-135, MSPA Claims 1 versus Tower Hill. We've got Mr. Zincone. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If not, please correct me. And Ms. Smith.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Mr. Zincone, whenever you get settled and are ready, no hurry.
May it please the court, good morning. Francesco Zincone here on behalf of the plaintiff, MSPA Claims 1, LLC. The government's cause of action under the MSP Act is nearly identical to the private cause of action utilized by Medicare Advantage. Both are designed for the recovery of Medicare dollars spent by Medicare payers that pay in the dark, as this court has recognized numerous times over the course of the last 20 years. The government's cause of action is the most natural lender of the applicable statute of limitations as a result. And that statute of limitations, triggered by actual notice and which places the control of the statute of limitations in the hands of the party that has been on multiple occasions recognized by this court as the party in sole control of the relevant information showing responsibility to pay, is essential to maintaining uniformity and serving the statute's structure and purpose. The record in this case makes that abundantly clear. The defendant, Tower Hill, which is a liability homeowners insurer, admits that it settled a Medicare beneficiary's bodily injury claim and admits that it had primary payment responsibility to reimburse any Medicare payments that had been made as a result of that accident. It didn't. The record is clear on that matter. In fact, the defendants acknowledge that in their answer and affirmative defenses.
Can I ask you just a question before we get too sort of deep down into the weeds of sort of when the three-year statute began to run? It seems like there's raging agreement now, finally, among the parties about which statute you ought to be borrowing. But I guess before we sort of get there, can you explain to me why it is that 1658 doesn't provide the relevant statute of limitations? I just don't think I understand why it doesn't.
Yes, Your Honor. And with respect to 1658, the point of reference for Section 1658 is whether or not the cause of action, the rights being asserted, arise under an act of Congress which postdated 1990.
Right.
Certainly, I recognize why this was raised by the court, because Medicare Advantage, Medicare Part C, was enacted in 1997. As laid out in the supplemental briefing, a lot went on before 1990, which involved entities just like this. And so if we look at the case that the court pointed us to, which is Donnelly from the Supreme Court, the language in the opinion lends itself in this particular instance to recognizing that the rights and liabilities that are concerned in the cause of action asserted in this case arose under acts of Congress which predated 1990, as laid out in our briefing. 1972 was the first time a Medicare substitute HMO came into being.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I'll confess to having been scarred by Donnelly, because I argued part of it and lost it 9-0 in the Supreme Court, so I know all about it.
To
my regret, read Donnelly again. It says, you know, if the plaintiff's claim against the defendant was made possible by a post-1990 enactment, and it just seems like, I mean, we've said, right, that the 1997 Act created these MAOs.
It created Medicare Advantage organizations, but Medicare Advantage organizations were a rebranding in 1997 of risk-bearing entities which had already been in existence really in this very form since 1982. I'd say at that point, the type of risk arrangement that a Medicare Advantage organization avails itself under and which was promoted promoted and expanded by Medicare Part C had already been in place. So when we look at, we have made, understanding the made possible by language, I think it needs to also be read in connection with new rights and liabilities, which is also, you know, liabilities that are created by virtue of the subsequent, you know, this subsequent act of Congress, which is also noted in Donnelly. And if you take those two and put them together, if we look at what is the right of action, the right of action here is an action to recover double damages with respect to Medicare payments that have not been reimbursed. The liabilities have been there, and the liabilities were there prior to 1990. It was nothing new. All the primary payers in this situation have always been expected to and should have already been on notice that they had an outstanding liability for any Medicare payments that were being made. And if you look at the actual MSP Act, where the secondary payments are actually established in paragraph B, it states that these are all payments under the subchapter. That is exactly how this court looked at, you know, analyzed that very provision when we were looking at Western Heritage and looking at whether or not Medicare Advantage organizations could bring this cause of action. It stated, the court found, that it was that provision that rendered all Medicare payments subject to, you know, to reimbursement in these precise type of situations. So you have from 1970, 1980, an integrated whole where dollars from the Medicare Trust Fund are subject to reimbursement by these very types of entities.
Counsel, you talked about who has the knowledge of the information. You're insured, or the assignor is insured, knows about the payments. They make the payments for the medical services, $8,000 or so, and they have an insured who has the money. Okay. And all they're going to do is ask the insured.
Well, in this, we're looking, I think, at two different issues with respect there. So with respect to,
I'm talking about who has access to the information.
Who has access to the information?
That there's a potential claim.
Yes.
And I had the same question. The MAO pays the insured's medical bills.
That's correct.
And the MAO knows at the time they paid the medical bills what they paid them for. It was for a fall. Okay. They know whatever. And you ask your insured. I get them all the time. I've fallen. And my insured sends me a form. Is there, it was at work. Was it work related? They say, did you fall? Are you suing a third party? Or I get them anytime you have go to an emergency room. My Blue Cross Blue Shield insurer writes me as a federal judge, hey, is there anybody you're making a claim against? Because they want to then give notice of a lien. That's how it's always worked. Now, I don't know about all this Medicare business, but every insurance company does that routinely, which I don't understand why Medicare Advantage plans don't do that too, particularly since they're supposed to be try to go get back the government money from whoever I'm suing. Why is that not the case here?
I would say, with respect to just the last point that was made, it is incumbent upon primary plans to make sure that money is being reimbursed. It is not set.
I'm not getting to that yet. I'm talking about who has, just Kelly's question, who has the information to begin with and is the best person to provide the information in this system, not what your legal liabilities are, but about payment. But who knows that the claim is being made, a liability or some other claim? The insured knows, right?
An insured would know to a certain extent, but the liability and the
and the insured and the person who pays the claim, i.e. this Florida MAO, knows. Ask their insured.
I understand what your honor is asking. So I want to look at sort of the anatomy of a claim from the start and understand sort of the factual scenario here, which would have led to it. So when you have a claim that is submitted to a Medicare Advantage organization like Blue Cross is receiving a claim. It's receiving a claim from a provider for reimbursement of
X-ray for broken bone.
Correct. That is taking place before anything with respect to a claim has been lodged by a Medicare beneficiary against anyone. Yes, there might have been there was a slip and fall, or yes, there was a car accident. But Medicare Advantage in this scenario is getting billed by a provider.
Right.
Like this court is right now. That's being done in the dark. It's being done in the dark with respect to the situation and the circumstances of the underlying accident, slip and fall, which ultimately later on give rise to the liability under the Medicare Secondary Payer Act. So Medicare Advantage, just like Medicare, gets a clean claim that is submitted. That's a claim that is facially sufficient. That's paid.
So that's the same thing Blue Cross Blue Shield works. They get a clean claim. They don't know. They just send out this form and say, because we are want to subrogate if we can, or we have a statute, we become, if somebody else pays, they have a primary payer, whatever they're called.
So it's paid within 30 days, and some may send those sorts of forms out in either the commercial or in the Medicare Advantage context. But what the way this statute and the regime that is set up by this statute, it recognizes that a primary plan is ultimately fully in control of all of the information regarding its own obligation to pay, how it is in fact primary to Medicare. So
is it called all of that aside? Under your interpretation of the limitations issue, there is absolutely no incentive whatsoever on the part of the party paying the under C paying for the bills to ask the their own client, have you gotten money from somebody else? Were you in an accident? Did you get an insurance company? So forth.
Certainly there is
no incentive whatsoever. So if you treat this as a statute of repose in which the claim begins immediately, whether they know it or not, there's an incentive to make the inquiry.
We're looking.
Agree with that.
There is an incentive, Your Honor, because
if you treat it like a statute of repose, you know what that is.
Yes.
That if you do that, then there's every incentive in the world for the party paying secondary payor to make inquiry, because it has the information.
It has access to
Tower Hill didn't have any information about what was going on. They make a settlement. They make these filings in order to escape a penalty. Well, I mean, and that's one of the reasons why these lawsuits are brought. They're for the penalty.
Put
it right on top of the table to get the penalty. And so
the penalty is there because this was not reimbursed in the first instance, as Tower Hill admits. That's what's there in the record. And this is a statute that is there to
from the point of view, from the point of view of just common sense, to have the payor have no incentive whatsoever to make an inquiry is silly for, in my view.
In this instance, there is, however, an incentive for the secondary payer to inquire, because it's unclear as to whether or not a secondary payer will ever come forward and actually make this happen.
Well they could just charge. They could charge their clients by raising the rates. I mean, whatever.
But this is what we're looking at here, and I just want to be clear, is that this is a statute which was built in order to incentivize primary plans to come forward and make sure that these reimbursements take place. I respectfully disagree.
How many years could go by before you would be barred under your theory?
Under our theory?
How many years?
3 years from the time that we receive notice that this settlement is taking place. That's what we've asked. So like I stated in my opening remarks, this is a very equitable statute of limitations under the circumstances. It places the entire control over triggering the clock in the hand of the defendant, which is settling the claim and has the beneficiary sitting at the settlement negotiation table with them. I see that I've exceeded my time.
I would assume that people like Tower Hill, the insurance companies, they file these notices whether or not the party that they're settling with is entitled to Medicare payments.
No, they would be queried for.
They just file all of them.
In this instance, they say that they file certainly all of their claims involving anybody who's Medicare eligible.
Anybody they settle with of any given age, they're going to file. You agree?
Well, nothing would get filed ultimately with Medicare unless the person comes back
and comes back as triggering
a subsequent report. Yes.
Okay.
Your client, or at least somebody along the chain of the process of whoever ended up being your client, gave notice of a lien, though. It was just too late.
No, there was nothing too late about it because Tower Hill never notified anyone.
Okay. But in 2014, your client did, they're in the dark, but yet they came and gave notice of a lien.
They did only after they, here's the way that this took place, which is completely...
It goes to, as I understood, the behavior of the person who first pays. They often try to find out if there's another. I know you dispute they have a duty to do that, and that they don't have a duty to do that. They can sit back and wait until a settlement, and then make the person who's paying notify them. But your client along the chain did give notice of a lien.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They didn't know about the settlement.
They didn't know about the settlement.
Yeah, and so then Tower Hill writes back, oh, by the way, it's already been settled.
And so you actually don't have a right to reimbursement. You don't have anything to give until the settlement has been reached. That's where the demonstration of responsibility actually takes place.
So why did your client give notice of a lien? Because that's what I see in lawsuits at state court. I mean, there were liens. Every insurer gave notice of a lien. Every kind of personal injury case I have, because they want to get their money back.
In 2015, MSP... the plaintiff here, after having done an extreme amount of investigation, which involved reaching out and requesting medical records.
You gave notice of a lien in 2014.
In 2015. That's where those communications were taking place. It was ultimately in September of 2015.
Why did MSPA give notice of a lien then?
Because it sent a letter to the defendant in this case asking for information, any information at all,
yeah,
regarding what might have happened, and then in response, a settlement was finally provided.
That's my whole point. You may still win on what you're saying, but that's my whole point. They sent notice to DL and said, look, what happened? Your MSPA, mm-hmm, when they got it, because they know this is going to be that. So why couldn't they, Florida Health or whatever the name of it, has done that as a matter of course to begin with?
Ultimately, this whole process involves querying third-party payment systems.
Right.
And this is an innovation on the part of the particular plaintiff here. But remember, when we're talking about this case, we're talking about Florida Healthcare Plus and the duties on Medicare Advantage. This applies to more than just the plaintiff in this particular action, which is...
No, we understand that. That's why, it's going to affect a lot of claims.
They had no reason to reach out and to Tower Hill one way or the other. In this instance, they had no notice of anything. They didn't receive the Medicare. They didn't receive any reports that were submitted to
Medicare. But at some point, they found they had notice to reach out to their insured, and that's how they found out about it.
In this instance, no. It was only upon MSP doing this sort of investigation and scouring through Medicare medical codes and then reaching out to providers where this one was identified. And so imagine all the others that are not identified by virtue of the very policy for not coordinating with Medicare Advantage that was admitted by the defendant in this action.
So your accrual rule, forget about what period of time, your accrual rule would be... when somebody pays, when Tower Hill pays the settlement, because Judge Schofield's question, that litigation could have gone on for 20 years.
That's right.
Right, before they paid anything.
If the litigation goes on for 20 years, well then, there isn't a demonstrated responsibility to pay until the settlement has been reached. That's what the statute is.
And then what do we do when there's a settlement like this one that says we just release? It doesn't really say, it does release medical claims, but it doesn't break down the settlement. We don't know what the settlement was for.
Ultimately, if it's a separate issue than what's before the court in this particular instance, but the Medicare manuals and the case law gives guidance on that. What is at issue is the entire amount if it ultimately included within the claim, there is a claim for bodily injuries, because the defendant has every opportunity at that time to make sure that whatever the lien is going to be is obtained and satisfied.
But the problem is insured doesn't know, maybe the lawyer should know, when they're settling this lawsuit just for $25,000 with Tower Hill, if there's been no notice of a claim for reimbursement of the medical. They don't know how to structure the settlement. They don't know, you know, to kind of say this covers pain and suffering, it doesn't cover medical expenses. That's what some of them do.
But that's exactly why the statute is there in the first place, to make sure that that is obtained and investigated at the time that they're crafting the settlement.
But the statute of limitations doesn't begin to run until Tower Hill pays. And Tower Hill, I assume, cannot be a primary payer until they pay. I mean, they're not a primary payer.
That is absolutely correct, that they are not yet a primary payer with demonstrated responsibility to pay under the statute until the time that they enter the settlement and pay the settlement.
Yeah.
That is separate and apart from when the statute of limitations is going to be triggered. They have to then go forward in order to trigger this running of the statute of limitations, and they have every opportunity to do so. They have to discern who the coverage is, whether it's original Medicare or whether or not it's Medicare Advantage, and it's as easy as sending a letter, and plaintiff's attorneys, personal injury attorneys.
But basically, Tower Hill has all the responsibility here to make sure the Medicare Advantage plan, who's already paid, gets their money back. That's basically what it is.
That's correct.
Tower Hill, who's not affiliated with Medicare, has nothing to do with it. Tower Hill's got all the
that's part of the standard business. The same way it's at, make sure that original Medicare liens are satisfied. It has an obligation that's been recognized by this court and is recognized really by Congress that they have to go out and reimburse Medicare Advantage the same way. These are Medicare trust fund dollars, and they have a benefit. They provide a direct benefit to the trust fund and to the government.
You know, some of us might think because Medicare Advantage plans are getting so much money, they might have a little role themselves to try to recover some of it themselves by sending a notice to the insurer. I mean, just might be, since Florida Health Medicare plan is getting all these trust fund dollars, maybe they should do a little something to try to find out if there's a liability claim. But maybe I'm just naive about that.
Yeah, you're good. Okay. It's all good. You have your 5 minutes of rebuttal remaining. Ms. Smith?
Nicole Smith, may it please the court, on behalf of Tower Hill, we ask that this court affirm the lower court order and find that MSPA's claim is barred under any of the available statutes of limitations. And I want to get right into answering the panel's questions and clarify some of the record if I could. Here, Tower Hill did report. Tower Hill reported immediately after it settled this claim. DL was injured. Allegedly, a dog ran out of Tower Hill's insured's house and either bit her or knocked her over somehow, and she suffered injuries. That injury took place in March of 2012. Tower Hill did what it was supposed to do. It immediately settled the case on behalf of its insured, and it reported the case pursuant to its Section 111 obligations. And that is in the record. There's a declaration from Angela Cole. Those are the documents in support of Tower Hill's motion for summary judgment. Angela Cole's declaration says that pursuant to Section 111 requirements, that information was transmitted to CMS in the next quarterly report. So that's how the 1395 YB8 reporting requirements work. They're on a quarterly basis. So to understand the chronology, the incident takes place in March. Tower Hill settles in June, and Tower Hill's particular quarterly program work so that the next quarterly report to CMS is transmitted the first week of September of 2012. So as of that first week of September 2012, this plaintiff's assignor, the MAO, Florida Healthcare Plus, was on notice via the Section 111 reports that a settlement had occurred. So that is where we have the demonstrated responsibility. In a settlement case, the way that the primary plan indicates that it has entered into one of these settlements is something called TPOC. It is a one-time report total payment obligation on behalf of the claimant. So that is now in the Section 111 CMS database. We know that this particular plaintiff and many others out in the world have access to this Section 111 reporting information. We believe we have plenty
of... this particular plaintiff, do you mean MSPA or it's SNR? It's Florida Health.
I mean both, to be clear.
Everybody does.
Everybody does. So what it's...
They're just an S&E. They're SNRs two or three back however far you
all of
them. They all have information, as I understand it, have that same information.
Absolutely, and that's in the record, Judge Joe Flatt. They're 30.
I mean, they have constructive knowledge of whether they look there or not.
You are correct, Judge. And in this record, the panel can rely upon the plaintiff's 30B6 representative, Natasha Blanco. In her deposition, she testified that MSPA Claims was trying out these different CMS-authorized portals. Data handlers, they're called different names. At the time that they were doing it, she said there were about 9 of them out there. And this was a direct distribution of data. If you signed up for a subscription, you had access to this Section 111 reporting information. So we know from Ms. Blanco's deposition that they were trying them out. And back in 2015, they had access, meaning the plaintiff had access to this information. We know also from the complaint because they attached a printout.
Well, they got access because of the assignment, I take it.
Perhaps.
Before that, they had no interest.
Right. There would be no connection otherwise to the primary payment. I don't know why you would want access unless you were trying to make some kind of a claim.
Everybody else down the line had access.
Right, and most importantly... Once they had the claim. And most importantly here is that FHCP, the MAO, undoubtedly had access to that data as well. Whether you believe there's enough in the record, we believe there is. Our district court judge didn't make a finding on this, but we believe upon a de novo review, this court can find that the data use attestation form that we submitted, we received from a subpoena from the receiver here because FHCP actually went into receivership. And every MAO has one of these data use attestation forms that says CMS is giving you MAO access to this data. The benefits of, there's a lot of acronyms here, let me make sure I got it right. We call it the Section 111, but the BCRC, the Benefits Coordination and Recovery Center, all of their data, these MAOs have access to it. And they clearly did here, undoubtedly, pursuant to the testimony of their own representative and pursuant to the attachment, which is just one of many of these CMS-sanctioned portals where somebody down the line can gain access. So to Judge Hall's point, there are other ways that MAOs can, or their assignees in this case, can gain access to this relevant information. We believe the most important way is through the Section 111 reporting information because, as Judge Joe Flatt noted, we wanted to avoid a penalty. The information is out there. We wanted to protect our insured. We moved quickly. We paid. We reported as we should. So here...
The filing, as I understand it, under the scheme, is made whether or not the insurance company believes this person is covered by Medicare.
That's correct.
I mean, just out of self-survival to avoid the penalty.
That's correct. And to be clear, this is a settlement case. So that is where we have the TPOC. There's different types of reporting that a potential primary payer is obligated to make. For example, in a no-fault case, there's something called ORM, ongoing responsibility for medicals. So that's in the case of a MedPay or PIP. They get the claim in. They have a report that they file that says, hey, I think we might be responsible here for medicals. And so that puts the MAO or traditional Medicare on notice that there might be another primary payer out there. And then there's a second report that the primary payer has to do in the no-fault situation, which is the termination of ORM, which is...
But let's assume that they looked, saw the notice, and you want to assume the accrual of the cause of action to be from that notice?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court determines that the appropriate statute of limitations to borrow is from 1395YB...
Whatever the appropriate statute of limitations is, you think that they were given... It should be from the time Tower Hill gives notice, does a certificate, they can know that there's some third party who's become a primary payer that they can try to seek recoupment for recovery from.
If this court adopts 1395YB, yes, Your Honor. Uh-huh. However, Judge Hull, I would also note that if the court alternatively, as Judge Newsom noted, wants to adopt Section 1658 or even the four-year state law, 95.11,
right.
Under either of those, then the accrual would take place from the time of demonstrated responsibility, which would be the date of the settlement. So that would be the four-year statute of limitation, either under 1658 or 95.11.3. That is... The accrual is when the violation allegedly took place. And in the settlement context, that is the time of the demonstrated responsibility. Here, in the Tower Hill case, would be the date of the settlement agreement itself, which is June 22nd, 2012.
And so all of this about the certificate is just the demonstrated responsibility was 621. And yes, they could have found out from the certificate that there had been this payment, that you had become a primary payer.
That is one of the many ways that they could have
found
out.
Okay, let's assume you've already settled and you've given the plaintiff the money, and then you filed the certificate. Let's assume they sued in 21 and it was timely under whatever statute of limitations. What happens then?
Then the claim would not be barred, but we would still have other defenses.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. What would your defense be then? Because you've already paid the money
right
to the insured, I mean, to the plaintiff. What happens then?
Sure. So under that scenario, again, assuming it's timely and they sue within whatever the applicable statute of limitations is, we would still have some defenses as to standing, as to the particular here.
Right.
Plaintiff, we would have defenses as to in any Medicare conditional payment. But
suppose it was no receivership and it was the Florida MAO. What?
Sure.
Was the plaintiff.
Or even traditional Medicare, Judge Hull. Uh-huh. There's always going to be defenses to make sure that the particular payment that was made by whether it be Medicare or the MAO is actually related to the underlying settlement at issue. So you have this scenario of, you know, this lady's glaucoma is being claimed and Medicare wants to collect for a payment they made for her glaucoma, but she injured her ankle here.
Yeah, right.
So there's still various defenses that can be brought up. But as to the statute of limitations, which is at issue here, Judge Hull, we believe under any of the proposed statute of limitations that the plaintiff's claim is undoubtedly barred. And under none of these statute of limitations should this court graft a discovery rule to it. I think that the Foudy decision is very clear on that. And the United States Supreme Court, Florida Supreme Court, all courts hold that the general rule is that the cause of action should accrue when the last element takes place, here when the violation takes place, unless there's some sort of act of concealment where we're going to actually graft that kind of rule, that discovery rule on there. Here, as our learned district court judge noted, there might be some lack of information within the MSP statutory scheme, but this is not a cause of action based on fraud. it's very different as compared to, for example, the False Claims Act, where there's information that is purposely being concealed. There was no information here that was being...
There's no theory, fraud theory you could make out of something like this, I think.
No.
In my view.
No, Judge Choflat, there is not. And their theory of trying to also read in the word actual notice into, if this court decides to accept the governmental three-year cause of action, is also completely impermissible. This court shouldn't write in words.
I don't think you could allege fraud in keeping with Rule 11 of the civil rules.
Yes, Your Honor. This would not, that would be a frivolous.
Well, especially somebody far removed from the transaction in the first place.
Right.
An assignee down the line of the claim.
Yes, Judge Choflat.
Would have a terrible time proving fraud.
Absolutely.
On that assignee.
Absolutely. And any difficulties down the line from a chain of assignment clearly shouldn't start the clock anew. That would be...
But what do you contend the statute of limitations should be then?
So Tower Hill posits that the appropriate statute of limitations is the three-year governmental statute of limitations. However, not grafting onto, you know, actual notice or requiring something more than 1395YB actually requires. All 1395YB requires is that CMS receive, it is the receipt of notice of the settlement agreement. There is no requirement under the federal government statute of limitations provision that it can only be triggered when the primary payer actually sends the settlement agreement itself. That's not how it works. We're not uploading settlement agreements. We're filing these TPOC reports, these ORM reports, you know, all of these reports, but there's no actual settlement agreement that is being provided. However, alternatively, if this court believes that 1658 or the Florida four-year statute of limitation found in 95.11 is more appropriate under Del Costello, you know, state law should be the first resort. However, here we do believe that the more suitable and analogous statute of limitations can be found in the Medicare Secondary Payer Act itself. However, if either 1658 or the four-year Florida state law applies, again, it would be triggered from the date of violation here, which is the settlement agreement itself.
Has any other circuit addressed this statute of limitations issue?
I see I'm over my time.
Yeah, please.
Can I continue? So, no, not as to the applicability to an MAO. We do have the Farmers case, which was just a district court in the Central District of California, which did apply the three-year governmental statute of limitations. Again, it was in the context of a discovery dispute, trying to define, you know, what records.
And does Tower Hill, if you know, get notice of liens a lot of times still, or is that practice really... when they an insurance company or some, I mean, because everybody's got health care. I mean, so normally it's just the health care, MAO or Blue Cross. You're a liability carrier. You may be a medical carrier too, but you're a liability carrier. Do liability companies routinely now get notice of liens still, or do you know?
I don't know. I know with this particular plaintiff's group, liability carriers had been receiving many lien letters. However, I can't say if it's with more or less frequency today.
Okay. Yeah, very well. Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Mr. Zincone, you've got 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you. Taking up some of the points that have been raised and notice by access seems to have been prominently featured both in the defendant's arguments and in the questioning from the court. This is one instance where the district court actually got this correct in applying, if we are to apply the three-year statute of limitations and graft that and borrow that over to the private cause of action, the district court was clear on its interpretation of the language in the statute. Notice by access is not at all, is not what that what was required. In fact, it states Tower Hill's notice by access argument hardly amounts to the, quote, receipt of notice the provision contemplates. Receipt has real meaning here, and it implies that something has been provided to either Medicare, if Medicare is the party of that has ultimately been responsible and is entitled to reimbursement, or Medicare Advantage in the instance of this case. In fact, with respect to whether or not Florida Healthcare Plus might have had access to these reports or access to the Medicare data, there is absolutely no substantial competent evidence in the record to suggest that Florida Healthcare Plus received these reports at all. And in fact, Judge Choflat's dissent in 2018 regarding the request for en banc hearing, rehearing of Western Heritage, Your Honor noted in one of the footnotes that, in fact, one of the most, frequently seen experts on the side of primary payers in these cases and in other commentary, Jennifer Jordan, had issued an article which you cited, which stated that Medicare Advantage organizations were not receiving the reports that were being transmitted by defendant primary payers to Medicare. There is nothing in the record here to suggest that anything like that took place. There's nothing to suggest that Florida Healthcare Plus received that, and there's everything to suggest that Tower Hill did absolutely nothing to go to Florida Healthcare Plus or the plaintiff and notify either one of them that they had an obligation to pay here. We talk about the distance from the transaction in question. The real transaction that gives rise to the payment obligation, is the settlement by the defendant of the underlying bodily injury claim that's been raised. It's the defendant at that moment, which in Western Heritage and in Baxter, this court recognized is on constructive notice that Medicare has made payments, or Medicare Advantage has made payments that need to be reimbursed. In fact, in Baxter, the court said that at this point, reviewing the entire structure put in place by the MSP Act, it can be read to suggest nothing but that a primary plan that is settling a bodily injury claim has constructive notice of the payments owed, and at that point has a...
Is your argument that the primary carrier has to seek out Medicare?
Yes. The primary...
On its own.
In fact, the statute is...
No, liability is one thing. They have a duty... Go knock on the door and tell them we made a payment.
That's correct.
Okay. What's your best case for that proposition?
Baxter. Baxter and Western Heritage. It states that that's when their reimbursement obligation is triggered.
I'm not talking about the reimbursement obligation. I'm talking about the duty to do something else.
It was just stated in 2020 in ACE, where the court referenced the reports that are being...
And then we should write an opinion in which we say that the primary carrier has an obligation to go ferret out the payor, the secondary payer.
It has an obligation...
To do it at its own risk. If it never finds the secondary payer, it's still liable. Indefinitely.
Maybe there's a statute.
Well, there's no statute of limitations on its obligation, is what I'm trying to tell you.
Under your argument, there is a statute of limitations that's applicable, and it runs.
Oh no! If they have an obligation to go knock on the door, the question then becomes: when does that obligation end?
Their obligation is it ends upon sending, putting the... Let's
no,
say
no, no, no. They got to go knock. They haven't knocked on the door. Now, when is the obligation of not knocking on the door end?
They haven't put it in our mailbox, I would say, is really what this is requiring. It needs to be received.
He's saying, when does the obligation of not, when their obligation of putting in your mailbox, when does that end? It never ends.
There are statutes of repose but that's not what really is at issue in this case.
I think there's a statute of repose, or it must be, or it never ends.
In Manning, when the court was considering, I believe...
Well, you agree with that. It never ends without a statute of repose.
Without a statute of repose, it would go on. But that's why...
Never.
Not necessarily.
Tower Hill would be liable as long as we're around here until it goes to the... secondary payer. Do you agree?
That's all it has to do. All it has to do is ask the Medicare beneficiary it's settling with. And so it's not really an, it's, I understand the question, it's not an insurmountable...
We're having a good time here. We're just disagreeing on two things. You're talking about liability, and I'm talking about another duty, an obligation to go tell them.
They go hand in hand because the obligation, it's not about liability under this cause of action. It's about the fact that this statute contemplates that that the primary plan is going to come forward and pay on its own initiative. So certainly, if it's going to pay... And do so without litigation and without notice from Medicare. That's what the court said in ACE, and that's what this statute sets out. If it's going to do that, it has to come forward and give notice. It has to knock on their door and say, what is the lien amount I'm ready to pay? Otherwise, if it didn't come forward and make some sort of effort, all it takes is a letter that sent after the defendant in this case settling the claim. Just like the defendant did the primary plan did in Western Heritage, sitting at the table and asking the beneficiary. It's not about whether or not a Medicare Advantage does or does not go out and ask the beneficiary. It could, and it certainly has an incentive to recover as much money as it possibly can, but it's important to make sure that it recovers all of them, and that's exactly what should be going to Medicare as well. And in order for that to happen, it has to be being done by the party that is in the best position, the second payer, and has all of the information right there in front of it and access to all of it to take the affirmative effort to do it. That's what the statute sets forward. It's not about whether or not Medicare Advantage really did anything. It's not about whether or not Medicare...
Yeah, because the second payer doesn't become the second payer until they pay. Okay.
Until they pay. And so
They're just a potential liability second payer. But I have this question.
I think Judge Hull has one more question.
Uh-huh. Without... regard to whether this makes any difference or not, just a record question. Is she correct that the CMS system, which has these quarterly certificates, is accessible by MAOs?
There is... It's completely absent from the record. It's absent from the record. There is the only thing that was provided in the record is a form attestation, which basically says that there is some level of access. But there is nothing in the record from FHCP, and certainly nothing from the plaintiff side.
Well, while I'm asking about it, we could always say that's something that needs to be answered before we'd say anything. So it's very important to me. So let's go to it, because you know the answer to it. So just tell me what the answer is. Not in the record, but there's a CMS. Let me break it down. Do they have to file a certificate? Does Tower Hill have to file something in the system when they pay?
They have to file something in the system when they pay. I want to be clear about what they have to do. Is right. They have, just the same way that defense counsel raised, they have to file
quarterly,
but it has to be specifics of the settlement sufficient that Medicare has actually received.
Okay, and we don't know because we don't have what they file, so I understand that. But they're supposed to put in the CMS system that they've paid on this, okay?
Supposed to be the amount, the date of the settlement, the date of the loss, the underlying Medicare beneficiary, a lot of the information regarding the policy.
Do they say the name of the MAO?
No, they would not say the name of the Medicare Advantage organization.
But they would say the Medicare beneficiary and some identifying a Medicare number, probably.
In order to report, they have to have the individual Social Security number. So that's the way they are reporting this information to the Center for Medicare.
So the settlement's in the CMS system, and my question is, does the MAO by subscription or otherwise have access to that? I'm not seeing it happen in this case. There's no record evidence.
There's no record that FHCP did.
I know, but do MAOs generally have access to that CMS information?
It varies across the board, and it also varies very much over time. In this instance, we're looking at a claim which was back in 2012. It may very well be that in a different case, on a different record, that Medicare Advantage organization, not FHCP, was receiving regularly the report.
Okay, all right. You've answered my question. Thank you very much.
So there is that, but in order for the stat, and I think we've conceded this point because it was one that was raised in our reply brief, that we weren't saying that if there was record evidence to suggest that the Medicare Advantage organization or the plaintiff actually received, in this instance, received a notice that it had been received.
Tell me what statute or regulation has the item receipt of notice. I've gotten so confused here.
Receipt of notice is expressly stated at 1395 Y.
Okay.
That's the government cause of action, right?
B2, B3, yes.
Okay, just the government cause of action statute. Okay.
The last couple sentences of the government cause
of action. Okay, thank you.
Very well. Thank you both very much. We'll be in recess until tomorrow at 9 o'clock. That case is submitted.
All right.
And can you come bring me about the book?